As you know by now, that's a lot of verses for me. And there's a lot of stuff in there. But you should also know I have a timer. So I got this. Thank you for your patience again. Last week we had an important topic that introduces this passage. If you weren't here last week, verse 6 would strike you as kind of coming out of nowhere. But it refers back to sins mentioned in the preceding five verses. And so there's this call. There's this call just to walk in the light. So I'd like to begin our time. There we go. It only works if the timer is started. I'd like to begin our time by having Judy play a short video for you. So this is a commercial that you'll see a lot of commercials today if you watch the big game. But this is a particularly powerful one and quite fitting for today's word and next week's. So I may play it next week as well. But Judy, why don't you go ahead and play that for us?
When we go off to war, when we exercise our rights, when we soar to our greatest heights, when we mourn and pray, when our neighbors are at risk, when our nation is threatened, there's someone to gather the facts, to bring you the story, no matter the cost. Because knowing empowers us. Knowing helps us decide. Knowing keeps us free.
I don't know if that tugs on any heartstrings of subscribers. Washington Post's tagline, "Democracy dies in darkness," is a good one. It plays on the felt human desire to have someone tell it like it is, someone to tell the truth. You know, give it to me straight. Don't tell me what I want to hear. Give me what I need to hear. And whether or not their journalism stacks up to that high standard, that's not what I'm here to sort out today, the standard itself is quite honorable, and it's not dissimilar to what we find in Ephesians 5. Just as democracy suffers when truth is held back or restrained, so too Christianity dies in darkness. It can die in the dark. And this, in this particular text in Ephesians, it's clear to me that there's at least two ways that that happens, where Christianity can die in the darkness. Importantly, neither of those two reasons are a function of living in a dark time or a particularly dark place, as if the light can be forcibly crowded out by culture. If the light is there and the light stays on, it cannot be crowded out or forced out. But there are these two ways that Christianity dies in darkness, according to Ephesians. The first one is the one I'll deal with this week, and it's one I harp on quite often because the New Testament does, over and over and over. And that is the failure of walking the talk, in this case, walking in light. So in this text in Ephesians, we are presented with this metaphor and this contrast, all in verse 8. You were darkness. And the emphasis is not purely on what we did, being sort of surrounded by darkness or being in darkness, but who we were. It's really emphatic here. We're supposed to feel it. You were darkness, not just in it. That's pretty stark. And it's not unlike Paul in this letter, as he said back in Ephesians 2, verse 1. You were dead. Not sick, not ailing, you were dead. And the same turnaround shows up in this passage as it does in that one. But God, but the mercy of God, but the light of the gospel, but truth through Jesus, but mercy. And so the contrast here, he says, now you are light. You were darkness. You are light. And before we get too pumped up on ourselves, important clarifier, you are not the light. You don't become Jesus. You are light in as much as you are in the Lord. To the measure that you are in the Lord, you are light. So you are light in the Lord. And it's a pretty basic call. Working out of that, he says, because you are light in the Lord, you're no longer darkness. Walk as children of light. Don't play dead. Do what you're supposed to. Obey Christ. And just like he didn't say we are the light, but we're light in the Lord, we might also notice that there's more going on than just our hearts, because he doesn't say you were the darkness, but you were darkness, as you were a participant in a dark world. You were right in the mix. But there is the darkness, there are the powers, the authorities, yes, the devil and demons, they exist. Those are there. And so we are not the darkness, just as we are not the light. And yet this contrast, you were darkness, now, he's writing to Christians, you are light in the Lord. That is all the reason we should need to walk accordingly. He's just saying, live out of your true identity. Don't fake it. Second Corinthians 4-6 demonstrates how this happens and just shows the same picture. Again, showing that the light is outside of us, but we come to be in it and participate in it and called the light. 2 Corinthians 4:6, for God who said, let light shine out of darkness, he has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. That is how we come to be light. In the knowledge of the glory of God and in the face of Jesus Christ. I think what this passage, at least part of it, is getting at in this, and this distinction between saying you are light, but you're light in the Lord, you're not light of yourself. You haven't turned this corner, and now you don't need Jesus anymore because now you're light. Now you just go autopilot. Jesus paid the entrance fee, and now you just do your thing. No, we have to stay in the Lord. And so I think a helpful metaphor for us to understand that, if I can pitch one to you, is that as we're in this world and in a dark world, and we are, and we should know it because we were darkness, sort of the best thing we can be in this world is a window. We're a window through which people can see the light. We are a means of the light entering into dark places and dark people. And we needed people to serve as windows for us to see through to Christ. So the implication, because Paul is assuming these people are Christians, the implication is that our windows often enough need cleaning. You can see through them in as much as they're clean. Lights can come through in as much as they're maintained. So spring is coming, eventually. And when it does, many of you will clean your windows. Maybe some will not. And it feels like a task that might not be that important until it's undertaken, but afterwards, when the light is beaming through so gloriously, and you can actually see the outline of your neighbor's house again, and it's worthwhile, and you see the reward, and and you get to enjoy the light. And our windows need cleaning. Now, there are exceptions to the rule. Jen Convey lives across the way from me, so when she cleans her windows, she sees more clearly kind of an ugly tan brown house with egg stains still on it, but we're working on that. But in our spiritual life, our windows need cleaning. And so, just as we have to do that in our house, just to maintain, you know, good light in our house, good visibility, how much more? How much more when we think about our spiritual life? Do we need to keep a steady stream of being cleansed? Especially when we consider the potential of what a window can do, helping someone to see clearly to Jesus versus being like one of those frosted windows. Maybe you see a little, you see some light, you kind of see a glow, but you can't actually see what's outside. You can't see what's through the window. So I think the call here to walk in that light, it's just a reflection. It's an acknowledgement that we came out of darkness, but we still are surrounded by darkness. And it's hard to be light in a dark place. Let me just jump right to sort of application here. Because there's a limit to how much we can clean sort of our own windows, especially in the spiritual life. There's a limit to how much we can do that, how effectively we can do it. If we were going to stick with the house metaphor, it's like I can get a good clean on one side of the window. In my car, sometimes it's just nasty in there, and I can't see through. So I always assume and just kind of hit the wipers on the outside and throw a little water on it. But sometimes when it's really nasty, the problem isn't the outside of the window. It's the inside. And you got to clean that side too. But it's hard to clean both sides of the windows. It's hard to get that clear view of ourselves by ourselves. I've said this before, but it's like with blind spots. They're called blind spots because you can't see them. This is one of the most important needs of being in the church. We need to be in the church regularly, a local church, not just the Big C church, but a local church regularly, so that people can help us clean our windows, so that people can speak truth into our lives. We need people who love God enough and love us enough who will get a second set of eyes on us, who will actually say something and not just let us go when we're stumbling. Just let us go, assuming they'll come back. You know, God loves them. God will draw them back. It's not for me to do. It's not for me to say. But Ephesians, especially if you go back to chapter 4, it just again and again and again tells us Christians aren't to be mute. We're to be speaking, speaking, speaking. And all of that is limited by love and by grace. But there's also the requirement of us speaking truth. And so we need to be in church regularly, a local church, not just a bunch of different ones. Dave, you are the only person who gets an exemption here. But even you know the feeling. you have to be accountable to the same folks regularly, or that window is going to get real dirty. And your witness is going to get real murky. And people aren't going to see clear to Jesus through you. And so we need the local church and people who will actually ask us, hey, how's your faith? How's the battle going? Something seems off. But we don't get that when we just pop in and pop out, when we don't let people get to know us. I'm kind of harping on this point, but it's why church hopping or church dating as a long-term behavior, okay? There's a difference between short and long-term, just like romantic dating. You know, dating for the rest of your life, a bunch of different people. Not recommended. It's the same with church. Church hopping as a long-term behavior is miserable. On one side, it's what you do to the churches when you church hop. You burn a bunch of potential suitor church families and leave people hoping and hanging in your trail. But more than that, and that's pretty important, I think that's significant enough to stay in a place even if, you know, in a particular week they didn't play a hymn or a nice contemporary song. It's worth sitting down for the sake of others, but even for yourself. If you're just church hopping, you get burned. And your window gets covered in muck. And you can't see well enough to wipe it off yourself. You need the help of the church. But when you're hopping all around, you provide a natural barrier to God sanctifying you. You provide a natural barrier to people loving you and people knowing you and people caring about you. So whether it's here or it's somewhere else, eventually you got to become part of the family. And obviously there's times where people have to split up, but the point I'm focusing on here is that church hopping is really this pervasive guard against having God cleanse you and purify you. I'm not being legalistic here. This is just the call of the text. Walk in light. And we need to be partakers and partners and fellows and members with the right folks to do that. But the focus in these verses, admittedly, isn't about church attendance or the benefits of corporate worship. That comes more in verses 19 to 21. And Aubrey will be preaching on that in 2 weeks when I'm away at Berea. The focus here is being careful not to. These are warnings, places not to be, people not to be shacked up with. And so just quickly, I'm not going to drill into each of these because I only have 2 minutes. But the focus here is to A, this is from verse 7, not be a partaker, not an active participant. It doesn't mean you have no connections to people outside the church. Lord, have mercy on us when we do that, when we cut off everyone. But the point is not shacking up and tying our wagons or our horses or however that metaphor works to the wrong people. So that's verse 7. And B is not participating in the dark works themselves. You are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. And again, this is tough because we're not totally separate. We're wedged right between darkness and light. As awkward as that looks up there, that's how it feels. We're just wedged. We're children of light, but we are surrounded. And even within ourselves, we feel the competing desires of being a child of God, but having flesh that does not want to cooperate, that really wants to recede into darkness. And so the call here in verse 11 is don't participate in dark works themselves. So there's a lot more here than just don't enter the wrong romantic relationships. But I'm going to let God apply that this week and maybe return to it next. Man, 20 minutes goes fast. This is going to be tough. But I need to work just like you guys are, and I'm calling you to change and be different. I need to do the same, and I need to leave a big open spot for my brother Parviz to speak to you and tell you of his experience of coming into the light, but also presenting the light to others, which will be the focus of next week. I'll just leave you with the words of Jesus. Because what Paul is hearkening back to is Jesus' expectation that we will do as he did on the earth. And a powerful representation of that, that I'll get into next week if I can, is Matthew 5, 13 to 16. You are the salt of the earth. But if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. And in addition to that, and this is really where we're going next week, you are the light of the world. It's you or it's nobody. You are the light of the world. You are the missionaries of South County, period, end stop. Sometimes we get an injection of outsiders, like when we run our Brazil VBS. But you are the steady stream of light here. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. Next week, we'll return for the harder part of this text. And I'll definitely need more than 20 minutes, but I won't take an hour and 10. Next week's message is really hard to get our heads around. So I would encourage you to read this passage this week a couple times and really focus on what's going on with this light exposure. What is God seeking to expose? Who is he calling to do the exposing? Because it's a lot to chew off.